Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This past March, the Truman Presidential Library joined forces with the University of Missouri, Kansas City to host the first in a series of three conferences to be held this year and next on the Cold War. The conference, which brought together leading scholars from around the world, took place in Kansas City, and it was my pleasure not only to attend, but also to interview one of the conference co-chairs, Melvin Loeffler. We'll air that interview on this week's show. After that, Fiona Beatty will tell you about an online source where you can learn more about the Cold War, and Michael Waldman, our guest commentator for the week, will offer us his thoughts on the history of political reform and limiting the influence of Washington lobbyists. But first, let's take a look at an article on history in the news you may have missed on the origins of the Cold War. It would seem that it's true. All views are relative. In this case, on the Cold War, and more particularly on what happened at the onset of the Cold War at the Yalta Conference. Yalta, as you will recall, is the Ukrainian town where leaders from the Soviet Union, Britain, and the United States met in February 1945 to discuss the future of post-war Europe. 60 years later, the grandsons of those leaders met at Maastricht in the Netherlands to offer their views on the meeting. My grandfather had the highest regard for your grandfather as a wartime leader, British author and politician Winston S. Churchill told Stalin's grandson, a retired colonel and military historian. But he was concerned with what would be the fate of Europe with the Red Army on its doorstep and at its throat. Stalin's grandson said the three grandfathers were friendly personally, but in fact Stalin viewed the U.S. and Britain as enemies. They didn't have allies, only colonial interests, he explained. Danger united them. As soon as the war was over, Churchill wanted to start a war against the Soviet Union. Curtis Roosevelt, FDR's grandson and a former U.N. diplomat, said the decisions made at Yalta were mostly about realpolitik after the late entry of the United States into the war. Nobody got what they wanted from Yalta except the Russians, who were in a position to get it, he suggested. His grandfather had failed in his effort to get America behind the war effort until Pearl Harbor, although he was convinced Hitler had to be confronted, he continued. What he thought was, if Britain goes down, we're next. When we return, more on the origins of the Cold War with Melvin Loeffler. This is Talking History. It's my pleasure to have in our studio today a leading authority on the history of the Cold War, Melvin Loeffler. Mel is a professor of history at the University of Virginia, and he's in Kansas City on this Thursday, March 30th, to participate along with 20-some-odd other scholars in a conference on the creation of an international history of the Cold War, sponsored by the Truman Presidential Museum and Library and the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The topic of our conversation will be Professor Loeffler's conference paper, which he's titled Truman, U.S. Grand Strategy and the Cold War, 1945 to 1952. Welcome, Mel.
It's a pleasure to be here,
it's
Brian.
Good to have you. One of the things that's largely held to be true, we'll see if you agree, is that when Harry Truman became president in April 1945, he was largely uninformed as to U.S. or maybe more specifically FDR diplomacy and strategy, even in reference to the atomic bomb. To what extent was that really true?
It was definitely true, and President Truman himself regretted it, lamented it, and resented it. Subsequently, he did ruminate about how ill-informed he was, and he felt resentful that President Roosevelt had never confided in him, never discussed the outcome of the critical conferences at Tehran and Yalta with him. So when Truman became president, he was largely ignorant of the agreements, formal and informal, that had been made during the war. In fact, he relied tremendously on the person who would become Secretary of State, who he would name as Secretary of State, James Burns, who actually had spent part of the Yalta conference with President Roosevelt and who conveyed to Truman in much more explicit detail than he had ever heard from the president himself what had happened at Yalta.
Why do you think FDR failed to inform him?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it has to do with the fact that the two men were never very close. Truman was a selection that came out of political expediency, and Roosevelt often did not confide in people. And it was clearly a tremendous mistake on President Roosevelt's part that he knew he was incredibly sick during those last few months, but nonetheless did not really share the information that any successor would need to have.
Okay. But nevertheless, Truman's goal here, at least you write in your paper, his intention is to follow FDR's policies. But then you throw in there, but that wasn't quite as easy as we might think, because those policies, and I'm quoting you now, were fraught with ambiguities and inconsistencies. What did you mean by that?
Well, the biggest generalization to be made about that is that Roosevelt always articulated a desire to get along with the Allies after the war was over, that is to perpetuate the Great Coalition, and most specifically to preserve the alliance or some form of the alliance with the Soviet Union. In other words, Roosevelt always articulated as a desire to keep the coalition and some sort of reasonable relationship, cooperative relationship with the Soviet Union after the war. Nonetheless, the inconsistency came from the fact that as the war drew to an end, Roosevelt himself became increasingly uncertain about the possibilities of cooperating with Stalin, given the actions that started to occur in Eastern Europe, which worried Roosevelt a great deal.
Okay, so they may have worried Roosevelt, but now Truman's going to have to deal with them. No honeymoon. He's got a number of big issues coming at him. Maybe we can just talk about a few of them very briefly. The first one was ending the war in Europe, but certainly in Japan is the bigger topic.
Right. The big topic is how to bring about the end of the war in Japan. And there were a variety of aspects to this. One was, should the American government reconstitute the unconditional surrender formula, which might have provided incentive for the Japanese to surrender. There was a lot of debate about that issue, about modifying the unconditional surrender formula. The other aspect of the debate, which really wasn't so much a debate, related, of course, to the overriding question of whether or not to use the atomic bomb. There was the expectation that large numbers of American lives would be lost through an invasion of the Japanese home islands, hence the incentive to use the atomic bomb. There's no question that Truman, from the moment he started hearing about the atomic bomb, which he did not know about prior to Roosevelt's death, but which he was informed about immediately thereafter, his instinct was always to use the atomic bomb should it be ready to use it. Now, for the first 6 or 8 weeks of his presidency in May and June of 1945, there was still a question about whether the bomb would be ready, but it was successfully tested in the middle of July, just as Truman went to Potsdam to have the conference with Churchill and with Stalin. And while at Potsdam, he was informed of the successful test of the atomic bomb. And it's very clear that that had an enormous impact on Truman. He immediately decided, of course, to go ahead and use the bomb. He believed that it would save American lives, end the war quickly, and also have a significant impact on Soviet perceptions of American power, which in Truman's mind and in his Secretary of State's mind, James Burns's mind, would make the Soviets more amenable to American post-war wishes. That was not why Truman dropped the bomb. He dropped the bomb to save American lives and defeat Japan. But he certainly thought it would pay substantial diplomatic dividends by having an impact on Soviet perceptions of American power.
Okay, I just want to briefly underscore that last part, though, because there's some controversy around that, which is that Truman dropped the bomb as part of some act of diplomacy toward the Soviet Union. You don't subscribe to that theory. It may have resulted in that, but you don't say that that was his reason.
I do not think that was the principal motive, but it's important to say that the diary entries of Secretary of State Burns, Secretary of War Henry Stimson, some of Truman's own very close friends like Joseph Davies, are filled with entry after entry about the relationship of the bomb to post-war relations with the Soviet Union. Overall, Truman did not drop the bomb to shape relations with the Soviet Union, but he certainly understood that dropping the bomb would have that consequence, which he welcomed because he thought that it would make the Soviets more amenable to American wishes.
Okay, fair enough. Now, you mentioned earlier that FDR was going to have to deal with the wartime alliance, which was becoming more and more problematic with Soviet actions in Eastern Europe and so on. How did Truman deal with that?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Truman was riddled with a bunch of inconsistencies and ambiguities, much like Roosevelt. He clearly wanted to get along with the Soviet Union. In fact, when he met Stalin at the Potsdam Conference, he liked Stalin. He liked dealing with Stalin. He had no special antipathy towards Stalin. He wasn't horrified by the stories that he knew of Stalin's brutality. Stalin was a man, Truman felt, with whom you could do business with. And what Truman meant when he talked about getting along with the Soviet Union, he stated explicitly to his ambassador to the Soviet Union, Averell Harriman, in a conversation with Harriman, he said, "I want to get along with the Soviet Union so long as we can have our way 85% of the time." In Truman's mind, that probably reflected his perception of the relationship of power and, of course, his belief that the United States was a country with much superior values and therefore deserved to get its way. So Truman wanted to get along with Stalin, but on his own terms. Stalin, to a certain extent, wanted to get along with the United States, but definitely on Stalin's terms.
Now, a very large question here comes up, which is, when you look at the full scheme of American history, becomes really crucial, a turning point, and that is whether or not Truman was going to commit us to an internationalist policy, or whether we were going to withdraw once again, as we'd been for the entirety of our history as a nation, into an isolationist position. Mm-hmm. How did he think his way through? What was involved in that?
Well, Truman certainly was not going to return to isolationism. He was committed to what in those days would have been known as an internationalist position. He talked about supporting the United Nations. He talked about supporting the Bretton Woods agreements, which included the creation of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. He talked about expanding American trade and lowering American tariffs. He talked about American membership, I think I just said, in the United Nations. So in those respects, Truman certainly believed the United States would be a part of the world. The key question, of course, was what else did internationalism mean? Did it mean making commitments to support the security of Western European nations? Did it mean trying to contain Soviet policy in Eastern Europe? Did it mean containing Soviet policy in Iran, in Turkey? Did it mean reconstructing Western Europe? These were the ambiguities. So although Truman was an internationalist, in terms of designing actual policies toward the Soviet Union and toward the world as a whole, the concept of internationalism was very ambiguous.
Okay, let's talk about some of those policies or plans that he implemented as he had to respond to what was going on. The Truman Doctrine, where did it come from? What was it about and how was it implemented?
Well, the Truman Doctrine was a commitment to support the American way of life throughout the world. He announced this in March of 1947. It specifically emanated out of the circumstances going on in the Eastern Mediterranean, and most particularly the declaration by the British that they were withdrawing their commitments and their power primarily from Greece and Turkey. This related to the great financial strain that the British were facing in the aftermath of World War II. Coming at a time when there was an ongoing civil war in Greece, coming at a time when Truman felt that the Soviets had been probing in Turkey, coming at a time when they were imposing regimes on some Eastern European countries, not all of them, but certainly imposing communist regimes on Bulgaria and Romania, to some extent Hungary, Truman felt that it was necessary to make a commitment now to fill the vacuums, to make an affirmation that the Soviets would not be allowed to expand further. But this was an indiscriminate statement in the sense that where would they stop the Soviets? The specific commitments were to Greece and to Turkey. There was an explicit statement, again, that this was the beginning of a larger policy. But exactly what constituted that larger policy was still very vague. It would only be defined in the subsequent months, in the spring and summer of 1947, when the Americans began to formulate a design for reconstructing Western Europe.
The Marshall Plan.
That was the Marshall Plan.
Tell us about that.
Well, the Marshall Plan was key because what happens in the spring of 1947 is that Truman's advisors begin to try to define priorities for the first time. What are our real priorities? And it becomes indisputably clear that the key priorities are to rebuild the western zones of Germany, France and Western Europe, and Great Britain. This was the key to restoring a long-term power balance in Europe after World War II. Keep in mind that American officials and President Truman did not think that the Soviets were going to use their military power to drive across Central Europe and conquer Western Europe. That was not what was on the mind of Truman and his advisors. What Truman and his advisors feared was that the post-war economic decay and social turmoil and political upheaval in Western Europe would allow communists to come to power in places like France and in Italy and Greece. That was what was on Truman's mind, and he was also tremendously preoccupied with the floundering occupation policies in the western zones of Germany. Keep in mind, Germany was divided at the end of World War II. There was a Soviet zone in the east, and then there were three western zones, a very small French zone, a British zone, and an American zone. And the key to the Marshall Plan was to begin to rebuild, especially the coal mines and the metallurgical industries of the western zones of Germany, in order to facilitate the rebuilding of the overall economy of Western Europe and to undercut, therefore, the appeal of indigenous communist parties.
Okay, we only have time for one more question, so let's try to sum it up, if I can very briefly allude to your conclusion, which I thought was excellent. The idea that you want to make clear that Truman didn't limit his policies to deterrence and containment, that he had sort of an aggressive, we could say, position he took. The strategy of the Cold War and to win that war is basically what Truman was putting together at the end. And it's interesting when you reflect on his farewell address, he notes that. He says, people are going to remember my administration as the administration in which the Cold War began. But then he says, I hope they'll also remember it's also the time in which we set the direction for winning.
Yes, yes. And I think that's critically important. Most people think of Truman's policies simply as containment policies coming in the wake of George Kennan's famous long telegram and his X article, which talked about containment. But inherent in the containment policies, which all of American national security documents stipulated at the time, was the idea that first we will rebuild western zones of Germany, Western Europe, and Japan. Then we will tie the industrial core of Europe and Northeast Asia to the underdeveloped periphery, to integrate the industrial core with the third world periphery. And then, when you provide that sort of strength, the appeal of a reconstructed Western Europe, the appeal of a vital and vibrant Japan, would serve as a magnet. For example, the success in Western Europe would serve as a magnet to Eastern European countries. And over a long period of time, and Truman and Acheson and Kennan were thinking about a long twilight struggle, as they sometimes like to say, that the success of their policies, first in Western Europe, and in Japan, and of course in Western Germany, would create the long-term possibility of not only rebuilding the industrial core, but also of serving as a magnet and pushing the Soviets back out of Eastern Europe. And the national security documents of the Truman administration always stipulated that the ultimate goal was to get the Soviet Union out of Eastern Europe. The ultimate goal was to get the Soviet Union out of Eastern Europe and to reshape their attitudes, Soviet attitudes, toward the conduct of international diplomacy. That was what the documents actually said, that it would be a long-term effort, there was no doubt, but that was the overall goal. So inherent in containment was the notion of eventual rollback, never with the use of force. keep in mind. It would be done through the success of these other policies.
Well, it took time, but we got there. But thank you, Mel. Enjoyed having you with us.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Melvin Loeffler, professor of history at the University of Virginia and a participant in a conference on this March 30th on the creation of an international history of the Cold War sponsored by the Truman Presidential Museum and Library and the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The papers presented in this conference will be published by Cambridge University Press in 2009 or 2010, so mark your calendars well in advance. This is Talking History. The Cold War lasted decades and was multifaceted, and materials related to various aspects of the war can be found in several different places. But one of the best is at Mount Holyoke College. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
Mount Holyoke College has an extensive webpage devoted to documents related to American foreign policy in the Cold War. There are hundreds of links to documentation from pre-1945 to 1986, plus links to other resources such as the CNN special on the Cold War, the Harvard Project on Cold War Studies, and the National Archives. It is an excellent resource for those seeking answers to questions such as, when did the Cold War really start? Who caused it? How did the Cold War work? And was Vietnam a turning point in the war? Secondary sources include newspaper articles, oral histories, and conference papers. In addition, there are links to key documents such as the Bretton Woods Agreement, minutes of the White House meeting on the decision to drop the atomic bomb, June 18, 1945, and the Baruch Plan, the speech delivered by Bernard Baruch to the United Nations Atomic Energy Commission at its first meeting in June 1946. The opening lines have powerful resonance today. We are here to make a choice between the quick and the dead. That is our business. Behind the black portent of the new atomic age lies a hope, which, seized upon with faith, can work our salvation. If we fail, then we have damned every man to be the slave of fear. Let us not deceive ourselves. We must elect world peace or world destruction. For more information, go to mtholyoke.edu. That is MTHOLYOKE. Search for Cold War and follow the link.
And finally, as promised, Michael Waldman joins us to offer us his thoughts on political reform. In particular, he reflects on recent efforts to control the influence of Washington lobbyists in the wake of the case of Jack Abramoff and looks at the results of such efforts in the past. Waldman is the executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. He was director of speech writing for President Bill Clinton from 1995 to 1999, and is the author of several books, including My Fellow Americans, The Most Important Speeches of American Presidents, published in 2002.
Shivers are running through Washington, and it's not just the winter cold. The plea bargain by lobbyist Jack Abramoff threatens to ensnare key members of Congress in scandal. The case has everything: luxury skyboxes, politicians shilling for gambling interests, and lobbyists stealing from Indian tribes. It symbolizes Washington's extreme cash-for-policy culture. But how can we make sure things won't just go back to politics as usual? Throughout our history, reform sometimes follows scandal, but not always. True progress comes only from rare reform moments, when accumulated public outrage combines with potent policy changes. In the 1800s, everybody knew campaigns were financed by patronage appointees, but it wasn't until someone assassinated President Garfield because he didn't give him a job that we got civil service reform. At the beginning of the last century, Teddy Roosevelt got large donations from the insurance industry. T.R. told a reporter, "Sooner or later, unless there is a readjustment, there will come a riotous, wicked, murderous Day of Atonement." Eventually, Roosevelt won passage of the first federal law banning corporate political gifts. Another great wave of reform came in the 1970s. After Watergate, Congress established public financing and voluntary spending limits for presidential races. But unfortunately, scandals just as often lead to cynicism and fatigue. Remember the 1980s savings and loan collapse? After it was over, President Bill Clinton proposed reform. But House Democratic leaders soon got what Abe Lincoln diagnosed in his generals, the slows. I worked for Clinton then, and I will never feel more frustrated than I did standing in the Senate antechamber as reform was filibustered to death. So, can the Abramoff mess become a true tipping point now? It depends. It depends on the reform proposals. Yes, we need lobbying reform. But voters should insist on a stronger system to transform campaign finance once and for all at the same time. Public financing is the answer. For example, last year Connecticut passed a full public financing system for legislative and statewide elections after the governor went to jail. New York City has matching funds. Every dollar you give is matched by $4, which has helped competition and spur small donations, grassroots organizing, and democracy. Reformers, they have a role too. They've got to frame this issue not as a matter of hygiene, but as a way to give voters more power. Jack Abramoff was central to something called the K Street Project. That's the street in Washington where all the lobbyists work. And the K Street Project was an attempt to create a political machine, tying Republican politicians to business lobbyists. Citizens should demand that their interests are represented. Ultimately, politicians will press for reform if it's in their own self-interest. So let's hope the scandals of 2006 lead not just to lurid headlines, but to lasting change.
You've been listening to Michael Waldman, Executive Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law and former Director of Speechwriting for President Bill Clinton. And that's it for another week of Talking History. As I announced last week, with this program, Talking History will suspend production for what we hope will be a short period of time. As our regular listeners and members of the Organization of American Historians know, the OAH, which sponsors Talking History, is experiencing some financial problems with which it must deal. And toward that end, the organization has made a series of cuts, including Talking History. We, and they, hope this will only be temporary, but we'll be off the air for at least the next few months. Talking History began 8 years ago as an independent radio program originating in Omaha, Nebraska, airing on two public radio stations. Within a few years, we became the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians and grew to have an international presence both on public radio and the Voice of America. It's been a great run, as they say, and I cannot thank enough all of those who have worked for the show over the years, including my first producer, Cindy Workman, engineer Mike Hansen, my current right-hand person, Fiona Beatty, and engineer Alex Smith. I could not have asked for a better team. I appreciate the hundreds of historians, including the best and most highly respected in the business, that agreed to be on the show, in some cases more than once. I thank Gerald Zahavi at the State University of New York at Albany for his assistance in launching the show, and of course, the OAH and Executive Director Lee Formwalt in particular for adopting us. As I said, I hope we'll return soon. While we're away, I remind you that you can access our 8 years of weekly programs at the OAH website, OAH.org, where we'll keep you posted as well on the future of Talking History. And as always, in closing, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, and that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH. Until we meet again, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.